Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And we have a full episode looking at... What are we looking at? I'm looking at you.
I love how every week we're like, we have a full episode. Does that just mean that we taped the whole thing?
I know.
We got to the end? Like, is that what
that
means?
Well, we have a fantastic panel with a very special surprise guest. Rebecca Vallis is
That's
a panelist
right. I got demoted.
Today.
I got demoted
yeah,
this week.
I kicked you off of the co-hosting duties to be a panelist, talking about a recent report of yours.
Yeah, so big week here at the Center for American Progress. We did some number crunching because we do a lot of thinking about the intersection between mass incarceration and poverty. And we wanted to know, you know, we know that one in three Americans have some type of criminal record at this point, that that's the legacy of decades of over-criminalization. But what hasn't been known is how many kids and families get caught up in the aftermath of that. And so we did some number crunching and we found, hold on to your hats, that nearly one in two American kids now have at least one parent with a criminal record.
Which is a pretty appalling number. And so we dig into a bit what that means and what we can do to remove the barriers associated with criminal records for children and families. So we're joined by our boss, Melissa Botanek, the vice president of the Poverty Prosperity Program, but also our criminal justice correspondent, Todd Cox, who's a senior fellow here.
That's right. So that's a lot of fun. We also have on Matos. She is a mother living in Philadelphia, supporting three kids who herself has an extremely minor criminal record, and she's going to talk about how it has held her back and also how it's held her back from supporting her kids.
And you also interviewed one more person, right?
That's right. Keeping with the theme of mass incarceration and its intersection with poverty and what we can do as this conversation around criminal justice reform continues, we have on Joanne Wallace. She is the president and CEO of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association, and she helps us unpack the crisis of public defense in this country. Really, you know, public defenders having way too many cases, more than they can handle adequately, and what that means in terms of your access to justice if you're a low-income person accused of a crime.
So you have a couple good interviews, but I gotta say, I scored the exclusive by having Rebecca Vallis on the show. But before we go into that, just...
I was really hard to book, be honest.
Yeah. Oh my God, yeah, dealing with your agent. But... we actually wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about Speaker Paul Ryan and
yes.
his first major address that he had.
That's right.
30 minutes of talking about poverty and somehow what we can do to lift people out of poverty. Your favorite line, you actually wrote a great piece on talkpoverty.org about this. He called for pushing wages up.
That's right. So Paul Ryan, he gives his first major speech as speaker. He's given a lot of speeches, right? He likes to speechify, but this was his first speech since picking up the gavel. And he focused almost entirely on poverty, which maybe is unsurprising, given that that's one of his favorite topics. And he said some things that sounded like they could have come out of my mouth.
Right?
Or
when
your
I was
mouth.
Listening, I was like, huh, I technically agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, he said, you know what? We need to push wages up. We need to push costs down and get people off the sidelines. I sort of felt like it was the new clear hearts, you know, full. Wait, how
clear
does it go?
Eyes, full hearts.
Thank you. That one. Right. I never get that one right. But it felt a little bit coachy.
Coach
to
Ryan
me. Yes.
did the
Coach
did
Ryan.
The deed.
He did.
He got us mobile. And, you know, when I started thinking
yeah.
through some policies, and you
yeah.
outlined a good one in this piece to push up wages. Rebecca, I'm going to interview you some more. What can we do
but
to
this
push
is,
wages?
This is why I was like throwing things at the friggin' TV, right, when he was talking, because he's like, we need to push wages up. And all I could think was, my God, if only we had a policy solution that could do that. Oh, wait, we do.
Yeah, some sort of maybe a minimum wage.
Yeah, wouldn't that be brilliant if we could actually have the law of the land be that we need to pay people what it takes to live? I mean, my God, the thought of a minimum wage. Tracy, this could catch on.
You know, it's a pretty radical policy, But I think it might just work. I mean, the fact that Paul Ryan is endorsing it more or less means that I think we can get somewhere in this country.
In all seriousness, though, right? So he says we need to push wages up. Of course, he has, as our listeners know, I'm sure, he has voted against raising the minimum wage at least 10 times since he's been in Congress. So he can say nice words, but, you know, as we often say on the show, it's actions that matter. So, okay, he says he wants to push wages up, but he's not doing it. He also said he wants to push the cost of living down. And again, you know, if only we had policy solutions. Oh, wait, we do. And there are ones that he's opposed to, making sure that families can access high-quality affordable child care, because the cost of raising kids in this country is astronomical.
Making sure people have access to affordable housing because the cost of rents are rising more than incomes.
Making sure that we have a child tax credit that actually is enough for families, and strengthening it because, you know, again, going back to the cost of raising kids. I mean, meanwhile, we're in the middle of this conversation around tax extenders, and you're not seeing him or any other Republicans showing up and saying, yeah, we need to make sure to protect these working families' tax credits like that. So, you know, I just really, really ironic and frustrating.
Yeah, the thing that they're good about saying the right phrases, they have the right rhetoric, but they have the same old policies. As our producer Alyssa Peterson said, the only thing new about Paul Ryan is his beard.
Certainly not his ideas, which are the same warmed over conservative, we need to block grant every program and slash it and send them to the states. He also talked about getting people off the sidelines, and this reminded me of, remember, it was what, a couple of months ago, and he was considering whether he wanted to actually be speaker, and he said something about how, well, I just need to make sure I have enough time at home with my kids and my family, which sounded a lot like support for paid leave, except
sure
it was
did,
only paid leave for Paul Ryan.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Getting off the sidelines, but, you know, and we want more Americans working, just only if they're in members of Congress.
Right.
Like, okay,
right.
Thanks, Paul Ryan. Right. That really does help all the people that we're hearing from in communities across the country that are struggling to balance family obligations with work and even just having unreliable schedules.
Right.
That they can't, even when they have a job and they're dedicated to it, they don't know when their shifts are going to start. So there's a lot that can be done to get people off the sidelines, as Paul Ryan advocates for, but he doesn't seem to want to support the policies.
Well, he has an opportunity. He is hosting a big poverty summit on January 9th. He's told us he's going to be inviting all of the presidential candidates, the Republican presidential candidates, and he's going to be, you know, pushing a lot of this stuff that day. You know, I'll be honest, Tracy, I feel like I kind of want to do a call to the media, to people who listen to this show, to say it's really important that we hold this guy accountable and don't just give him credit for his flowery rhetoric that sounds like it's nice and it's new. We need to look at his policies.
Absolutely. And we can't give him a break just because he has a cool, hip new beard. He's got to do the work, too.
I don't think it's cool or hip. I think it's kind of scraggly and prepubescent, to be totally honest.
We'll have our debates over the looks of the Republican Party off the air.
On that note, onward to our conversations about kids who have parents with criminal records.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross.
And I'm Rebecca Vallis. While the effects of parental incarceration on kids and families has been discussed at length, less well appreciated are the family consequences that stem from the barriers associated with simply having a criminal record. CAP's new analysis, released this week, estimates that between 33 million and 36.5 million children in the United States, that's nearly half of U.S. kids, now have at least one parent with a criminal record. To discuss the implications of this new estimate, we're joined by our colleagues, Melissa Boteach, Vice President of the Poverty to Prosperity Team and one of the authors on the report, and Todd Cox, Senior Fellow focusing on criminal justice reform and Talk Poverty's own criminal justice correspondent. Thanks so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And we have to also note that another one of the authors of the report is present. Rebecca Vallis is an author.
Oh, what full disclosure we need to make. Yes, yes, I am also very interested in this issue. So
this will be a fun and well-rounded conversation. And again, I'm here so I don't get fined as the least qualified person of the four of us here to talk about this. But this is something that's important to our team. So this is going to be a great conversation. So, Todd, I want to start with you. So we mentioned at the top of the segment that parental incarceration has been discussed a little bit more at length. But could you just explain how some of the immediate effects of parents being in the criminal justice system impacts kids and families?
Sure. Well, you know, has been well documented actually by some of the work CAP has done. We know that involvement in the criminal justice system expands or extends beyond incarceration. So it's obviously connected to having a criminal record, period. And so the ripple effects of that not only impact our economy, impact our society and community, but impact families. It impacts family unification. It impacts someone's ability to get a job, which obviously impacts income and impacts the family's ability to save money and to have economic opportunity. It impacts housing. You know, an individual being able to not access housing because of a criminal record, that impact is exacerbated or increased or made worse if that person has a family and children. Not having a roof over your head if you have children is just that much worse. So all of the effects that an individual would have or a group of individuals would have because they have a criminal record is just made that much more intense if there's a family involved. And I think there are some particular recommendations that are key to making life better, I think, for everyone, both those who have the criminal record and their families that this report lays out.
Before we even go into those recommendations, I guess this question would be for the three of you, since you've been looking at this.
You've transformed me into a panelist,
I saw what you did there. I kicked you off the co-host panel. But something that I think might be surprising, you know, I someone who has been less steeped in these issues than the three of you, something that might be surprising is that even an arrest that never leads to a conviction counts as a criminal record that carries barriers with it. Can you all explain? Actually, I'll just go to you first, Melissa. Explain how these sorts of barriers stick with people.
Sure. Well, if you think about it, 87% of employers use criminal background checks, in which case an arrest without a record can show up. That's a huge barrier to employment for people with very minor criminal records. Similarly, 80% of landlords, 66% of colleges and universities use these background checks. And so whether or not someone has actually been incarcerated, the collateral consequences of having that criminal record, even a very minor one, can actually translate to a life sentence of poverty in many cases. And so that's one of the reasons we thought it was really important to take a two-generation approach to looking at this. How do we both help the person with the criminal record, but how do we also examine the effects on children and families and make sure that we're removing barriers for the entire family unit?
And Tracy, I'm really glad that you asked exactly that question, right? Because I think there's often this misconception that, oh, you have to have a felony record or even you have to have been convicted of something in order for that criminal record to hold you back. Not only do you never need to have spent any time behind bars, but you don't even need to have a conviction. You can have an arrest that never led to a conviction, and that can hold you back in a lot of the ways that Melissa just described. And there's actually a whole growing body of literature finding particularly the employment consequences. Having any lifetime arrest, doesn't matter how old it was, decades ago your arrest can have been, having any lifetime arrest is one of the most substantial negative factors that employers can see when they're considering you for a job. It weighs more heavily to them, research finds, than whether you have a high school diploma versus a GED, whether you have ever received public assistance, all the kinds of things that they might, you know, hold against a job applicant, whether rightly or wrongly, just ever having been arrested can really hold people back from getting a job. And as Melissa noted, that can have real consequences for kids.
And of course, it's the people who are most disadvantaged who are both more likely to have those kinds of arrests without conviction and who are less likely to have the resources to proactively go and clear their record. And so even though it affects
this huge broad swath of Americans, it's obviously disproportionately affecting low-income people and people of color.
And that's actually leads into another question that I have, that we know that 60% of people behind bars are people of color. The fact that one in three Americans have some sort of criminal record, we can surmise that a disproportionate number of those are people of color. What are the particular implications of this on children of color? If we know that half of all children have a parent with some sort of criminal record, what's the impact of children of color in this country?
Well, I think, you know, it just exacerbates the problem that much more. We know that our system, our criminal justice system, is replete with bias, both in terms of how folks enter the system, policing, those who are disproportionately arrested. We know that the war on drugs has disproportionately impacted people of color, particularly men of color, particularly black men. The crack powder cocaine disparity carries disproportionate racial impacts. All of that carries with it, has been already discussed, implications for the family. So all of the problems with arrests, that so-called broken glass, broken window arrests that were happening a few years ago, things that even are misdemeanors, as we've discussed, carry implications for that individual that lead to implications for their family. The ability to get a job, the ability to hold a job. One thing we haven't talked about is criminal background checks that occur once you're employed, and people being discharged or moved on because they later on find you have a record. People's ability to have a house or get a house or get housing, all impacts that individual, but then it impacts the family even more. So if people of color are disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice system, their children are going to be disproportionately impacted just as much.
Right, the number that this research is producing, this, you know, nearly half of U.S. kids now have a parent with a criminal record number, which is, we should sort of take a moment and even just recognize how staggering that
is,
right? I mean, maybe not surprising when you consider that as many as one in three American adults have some type of record, but still half of kids, right? That number, while our analysis was not able to dig deeper and to say how, you know, what's the breakdown demographically, how much worse is it for kids of color, but given that black men are 6 times more likely and Latino men are 2.5 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men, and nearly half of black and Latino men have been arrested by age 23 in this country, right? The impacts on families of color and children of color must be, you know, even much more substantial than this research shows.
Absolutely. And with the last report that you guys produced, One Strike and You're Out, you talked about how often people who are leaving prison or people who have criminal records and are returning to their communities, they're often returning to these high poverty communities with a large number of people of color because of the enduring effects of segregation. So we're having communities where you have a large percentage of the population unable to get jobs, unable to access housing, and this just has spillover effects for entire communities. And it goes beyond just one family. Also, it impacts your neighbors, it impacts the entire value of that you're bringing to your community. Melissa, I think I cut you off, and since you are my boss, I want to make sure that you get a word in.
Don't want that end up in your evaluation.
Yeah, that's right. Tisk.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think you made the point I was going to make more broadly, and also I think it's not just children's economic security in the short term, the poverty that they face because their parent has a criminal record today. A lot of the effects that we're talking about, whether it's unstable housing or a parent's inability to access education or college or to hold down a job. One of the things the report walks through is the ways in which these can have long-term economic mobility effects in terms of children's life chances for income, for education, for health. And getting back to the racial equity lens, this is not only sort of a moral outrage, it's also a factor in terms of our long-term economic competitiveness, because these kids that are growing up today are our future workforce. And if we are placing severe strains and limits on their ability to realize their full potential, in 2042, we're going to be a nation of majority-minority. Like, this is undercutting our long-term economic competitive edge in addition to being a moral outcry.
So I'd love to talk about some of the recommendations that are outlined in the report. And one of the things that's interesting, there's a beautiful graphic about the two-generation approach and how we need to address these barriers in terms of parents as workers, but also as parents in their role as parents. Can you, I'll start with you, Melissa, since you are our family structure expert. Can you walk us through a little bit more detail what this two-generation approach means?
Sure. I mean, a two-generation approach is one, again, that recognizes that children's life chances are often connected to their parents' ability to succeed and to invest in them. And that if we really want to take an intergenerational approach to ending poverty, yes, of course we need to invest in children, but we also need to invest in their parents and see them as their children's first resource. And so in terms of helping them as workers, that means looking at policies that remove barriers to economic stability, educational attainment, to building savings and assets, but also in looking at what are barriers to parenting, what are barriers to family time and to family stability. And to that end, some of the recommendations we make in the report are, for example, lifting up effective two-generation models like home visiting that both in the prenatal period as well as in the first few years of children's lives, having a professional at the parent's request, like a nurse or a social worker, come and be able to connect that family to community resources and to help address parents' questions, et cetera. And there's lots of evidence now showing that this particular kind of model is really having long-term effects on children's educational attainment, on their health outcomes, on parents, et cetera. So that's just one example of a two-generation approach on the family end that we're lifting up as part of this report to remove barriers.
Building off of what Melissa just said, so, you know, I think part of what's been really wonderful to see and what we've actually talked a lot about on this show over the course of this year is the growing national bipartisan conversation around criminal justice reform. And a lot of that increasingly it has to do with making sure that people who are formerly incarcerated or people who have a criminal record but even have never done time have a meaningful chance at a second chance, right? And what we really are trying to do with this report is to make the case that that's important not just for the individuals with the criminal records, but it's also really important for their kids, and that if we don't want to be setting up a whole next generation, half of which may be held back in these kinds of ways by their parents' criminal records, then, you know, we need to make sure that we are removing barriers to employment so that you're not shut out of the labor force just because you have, you know, even a minor criminal record. We need to make sure that people are able to access housing. Currently, there are these one strike and you're out policies in public housing, and also private housing can really be out of reach for people with records as well, which can also have real consequences in terms of allowing families to reunify. We need to remove barriers to education and training, like Melissa was talking about, and invest in education behind bars as well to set people up when they get out. And, you know, something that really isn't getting nearly enough attention, we need to make sure that we have in place sensible child support policies so that we're not, on the one hand, thinking that we're helping families by going after people who owe child support to the kids that they're non-custodial parents of, but on the other hand, feeding them right back into the criminal justice system and setting them up for failed reentry because we're asking them to pay amounts that they can't afford and locking them up when they can't pay. So these are just a handful of the kinds of recommendations that we're calling for, but really it's nothing all that new. It fits in with that larger bipartisan conversation that's happening, but just sort of tries to make clear that if we fail to enact this agenda, this policy agenda, then it's not just the people with the records who are going to suffer, it is their kids and their families too.
And I think the underlying assumption the report makes is that, and it's the correct assumption, is that parents who have criminal records, parents who are incarcerated, want to be parents. They want to be.
I love that you declared that your assumption was correct.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I can do that. I'm among friends.
I love that. You get to clarify that.
You know, my assumption is the correct assumption.
It's the correct assumption. And I think that's a bias that needs to be corrected. I think there's an assumption that because someone makes a mistake, they get arrested or have served some period of time in jail, that automatically means they wanted to be away from their family, that they don't want to be good parents. And I think one thing we'll touch on tomorrow during our event, rolling this out, will be that's just the opposite. The folks who are criminal records, who are incarcerated, are human beings just like anyone else. They want to be good parents. They need help doing that. And there are some recommendations in here that are going to make that possible.
And I think that's actually a really important point. Building off what both of you just said, for example, one-third of formerly incarcerated parents reported that their inability to pay child support has negatively damaged family relationships, including with their own children. And you look at the one-strike housing rule or other bars on public housing or family reunification in housing. A lot of times it has nothing to do with a parent's desire to reunite with their partner or with their children, but it's structural issues that are in place or public policies that have had unintended consequences over time accumulating that are really straining family bonds, which is something I think on a bipartisan basis we can agree is what we want to support.
I think one of the important things that Rebecca mentioned was that in many cases, these criminal records happened years ago. This could be, 10, 20 years ago, someone's criminal record can be plaguing them. We're doing a lot of work on this around a quote-unquote clean slate campaign, which is gaining traction in different states. Todd, could you speak a little to that? And I'm sure Rebecca will be more than happy to jump in to talk about it.
Sure. Well, I think the clean slate proposal is sort of fantastic because it's sort of the precursor to all of what we're concerned about and rightfully so about banning the box, right? Banning the box would delay the inquiry into criminal background into pretty far down the process of employment and this fair chance hiring. The clean slate proposal basically makes that almost unnecessary because you're offering someone an opportunity to clean the slate. Someone with a criminal record under certain circumstances, and Rebecca can jump in more about how it's being tailored to various states. Under certain circumstances, if a person has a misdemeanor, for arrests, it's automatically sealed. Their record won't be seen except by law enforcement. In other circumstances, after a conviction, after a certain period of time, the record will be sealed. So what does that do? That prevents an employer from being able to access someone's criminal record, make a decision biasing them against the person because they have the criminal record. So banning the box in some ways doesn't become an issue. And I think that's sort of the goal. It's the idea that if someone has made a mistake, they've served their time, they've spent some time not having done anything else that would violate the law, they should be given an opportunity for a second chance. And what better way to do that than up front with sealing their record? Law enforcement is in favor of it largely because they have a chance to actually see it. So for background checks that are necessary for law enforcement, they can still access the record.
Todd, you have outlined that so beautifully.
Well,
Rebecca is rendered speechless.
No, the only thing I would add. Oopsie, I found something.
Of course.
The only thing I would add is that part of the reason that this proposal, this clean slate idea, is gaining bipartisan traction in states across the country, including Pennsylvania and Michigan, most notably, is because actually a lot of conservatives see it as a conservative idea that what they're trying to do is to remove government obstacles, as often they put it, so that people have a fair shot at succeeding, right? And so by removing that record, that government obstacle, they're getting government out of the way and allowing people the chance to get a job, to get housing, and so forth through their own hard work. The other reason that it's actually being couched as a conservative proposal by many state lawmakers and also stakeholders is that it will translate into vastly reduced expenditures by state courts. Currently, individuals who are seeking to have their records expunged or sealed, they have to petition the court and individually, right, on a case-by-case basis. They have to file petitions. They have to go before a judge. The district attorney has the opportunity to say whether they support or oppose it. It's a really labor-intensive, time-consuming process, and it means people can wait for, a year or longer just to have their day in court to have an arrest from 15, 20 years ago expunged, and it means a really, really big expenditure of court resources. What the clean slate policy would do by automatically sealing those records under those circumstances is it would save people needing to find legal representation and going before courts, but it would save the courts that whole workload, which would mean substantial savings at the state and local level.
I think it's important to note that at the heart of that policy and this new analysis around children and families is the idea that if people pay their debt to society, they shouldn't continue to pay it in perpetuity. That the laws that we have should be designed to, if you commit some sort of crime, you know, then you do the time, as, you know, people like to say, but that if we make it so that you're continuously punished for being punished, that doesn't make any sense. And it's as if people can't be reformed. The clean slate idea is saying someone has paid their debt to society and then they've been an outstanding citizen. Why should we continue to punish them? Something that what we have not yet spoken about, though, is, I guess, the policing of certain communities, and that in some instances, people are arrested not because they committed a crime. And so they really shouldn't have to pay a debt to society for something that they haven't done. Todd, I'm looking at you because I know that your portfolio is broadly around criminal justice reform. It feels like these sorts of policies like stop and frisk and levying fines and fees on communities are deteriorating police-community relations. And like we said earlier, a lot of people who are leaving prison are going to the same sorts of communities. How can we do more to ensure that trust is restored between law enforcement and communities that are highlighted in this report and other work that we've done?
I think it's a very good point. I think the first thing I would say is transparency. I think that I mean that in the broadest way it could be used. Transparency in terms of everyone understanding why the police are in a community. They're there to enforce the laws and protect communities, everyone. And I think, unfortunately, when you're living in a predominantly African-American, predominantly Latino community, the police are sort of set up as people who are guarding, frankly, folks who live in those communities. So folks in those communities can't rely on the police to come to their aid when there's actually a crime being committed in their community. They only come, the perception is, and it's not necessarily wrong, when the police believe something is going wrong, that they're doing something wrong. There's a lot of bias in the communities. People perceive there's a lot of bias amongst the police forces enforcing the law in the communities. So I think, you know, a sort of a shared understanding as to what expectations exist in communities for policing, both in terms of protecting people who live in communities, but also a shared understanding and agreement that that police will not be biased against the communities they're protecting are key. And we have some recommendations on the table, two of which involve training, implicit bias training for police and law enforcement, so they understand their own biases that go into the decision making they make, and assumptions they make about people in communities. But then also data collection, to transparency as to how often are police engaging communities in a way that we would define it as inappropriate, either through shootings, killings, or other ways. We just don't have enough data to actually be able to make informed policy, and we recommend that as well. I want to also add that, you know, the police are one part of the factor, but there's discretion all along the criminal justice system that leads to people having criminal records and being incarcerated in a way that's inappropriate. So prosecutors, I think, need to be part of the equation as well. So the police are often the first responders, but they don't want to be seen as the only people responsible for bringing folks into the system. Prosecutors have an enormous amount of discretion in terms of who they charge, whether or not to divert people, and whether or not to actually charge people and bring them into the criminal justice system. So that needs to be an important part of this as well.
And Tracy, you made a really important point. I know we're short on time, but I would be remiss if I didn't say, given that you mentioned sort of the transformation of punishment from a temporary to often a lifelong experience, that's what all of these kinds of collateral consequences do. But most notably, that's what these fees and fines that finally got attention with Ferguson do. It traps these individuals and whole families in really a cycle of inescapable debt, and can really translate into a path back to what ends up being debtor's prison when people are too poor to pay those fines and fees. Ferguson was hardly an isolated incident. Sadly, there are Fergusons happening all over the country in terms of low income and communities of color being the ones basically being forced to fund the municipal governments that are trying to close budget gaps. They're doing it on the backs of low income people of color. That's happening nationwide. And families and kids are also paying a steep price.
Right. And what I hope, building off Rebecca's point, what I hope this report sheds light on is that all the issues that we talked about today, they're a family affair. And that it's not just about the person who's had interaction with the criminal justice system, but the number of children, the number of family members is actually it's astounding. And I just to sort of close out the fact that nearly half of all kids in this country are somehow interacting with this through a parent that has a criminal record should be sound an alarm that now is the time to act. Now is the time to act in a bipartisan fashion to really both reform the criminal justice system, but also address these barriers through holistic family and anti-poverty solutions.
Absolutely. Melissa Botayak, Vice President of the Poverty to Prosperity Program, and Todd Cox, Senior Fellow here at CAP. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. We often talk about the 100 million Americans with criminal records, and now the nearly one in two U.S. children who have a parent with a criminal record. To help us put a face on how parents' criminal records affect not just them, but also their children and their families, we're joined by Matos. She's a mother of three in Philadelphia who's struggling to support her family because of a 10-year-old misdemeanor record. Thanks so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about how you ended up with a criminal record.
I was at a block in Philadelphia, in Westmoreland. And basically, I was witnessing someone getting stopped by police enforcement. And I started recording. And, you know, my phone, they tried to take my phone away, and I pulled back, and, you know, they ganged up on me.
They, the police?
Yes.
And what happened?
I was hit with, I believe they call it the nightstick? I'm not too sure. I was beaten on my head, on my arm, and then I was arrested.
What did they arrest you for?
They were charging me with several charges. One of them was 100 apprehension, interfering with law enforcement, and disorderly conduct.
So basically, you were trying to record police brutality on your cell phone, and the police tried to take the phone away from you and told you to stop recording, and they beat you up?
Yes.
And then they charged you with a crime?
I was in custody for about 10 hours before they even figured out what they were going to charge me with.
So they ultimately charged you with disorderly conduct. Is that right?
That is correct.
And that
I was found guilty.
And you were found guilty. And that offense is a third degree misdemeanor. So a very, very low level offense. But how has having that really, really minor record, which I think probably a lot of our listeners would agree with me, you shouldn't even have a record after that series of events, but how has that really minor record affected your life?
It has disqualified me from positions that I know I'm well qualified for. That box on the application that asks if you have been convicted of a misdemeanor or a felony, I have to check that box. So that automatically has blocked me from obtaining a job that will allow me to support my family.
And before we get into talking about how it's affected your family, because you're a mother of three children, before this whole set of horrible events happened, you had been working. You were working at Blue Cross Blue Shield, is that right?
That is correct.
And what kind of work were you doing there?
I was doing customer service.
So why didn't you just go back to that job?
After the incident with the police, I went on a family medical leave. And then once I was required to come back, I couldn't. I was still traumatized. So what happened was I had to reapply. But once I reapplied, I already had the charges on my record, and I had to check that box. And they told me, unfortunately, because of the nature of the work, they will not be able to consider me.
So how has that affected your ability to support your family and your kids?
Well, I mean, right now I'm working for a family member. My stepbrother, he has a small business. And, you know, even though I am getting paid, it's not a lot. He really can't afford to pay me what I am worth being paid. And I've tried numerous times to apply to different positions. I've went on numerous interviews, you name it, I've done it, and it's just, you know, some people just never call back. Other people have the courtesy of calling back and saying, I'm sorry, we can't consider you. So it's really affecting, because unless I want to work in, you know, in a specific setting, which I don't, in the fast food setting, where I'm not, you know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, it's not enough to support my family. I have three boys. I am a single mother.
So what are you doing to make ends meet?
I am under public assistance.
How long ago was the series of events that we talked about that left you with a criminal record?
This was in 2005, I believe. I'm sorry, 2006.
So how does that make you feel as a mother of three children who isn't able to support your family because of this criminal record?
It makes me feel limited. There's not much that I can do if people won't give me the chance. I mean, unless I want to, you know, work on my own business, which is hard as it is, it's limiting. I can't provide more than what I'm able to go out there and get. I mean, unless I want to, you know, which a lot of people do with criminal records, they turn back into those ways because there's no way out of it.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and for helping us to put a face on the importance of public policy and making sure that people can have a second chance.
No problem. My pleasure.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. As we discuss strategies to reduce mass incarceration and to remove barriers to opportunity for people with criminal records and their families, a critical but often overlooked piece of the puzzle is public defense, which has long been dramatically underfunded. Illustrating how dire the situation has become for many public defender offices, this fall it came to light that the Orleans public defenders in Louisiana had turned to crowdfunding in hopes of closing a $1 million budget gap. With me to discuss the state of public defense in America and what it means for low-income communities is Joanne Wallace. She's the president and CEO of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. Joanne, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Joanne, the Orleans public defenders' decision to crowdfund got a lot of attention when that news broke in September. And perhaps most notably, John Oliver actually included it in a segment about how badly underfunded public defenders' offices are. But before we get into what that says about the state of public defense, I want you to sort of help take us back, explain what is the right to counsel, what role do public defenders serve, what does right to counsel mean?
Thank you, Rebecca. So America was built on the promise of justice. Our children pledge allegiance to a flag that represents a republic that stands for liberty and justice for all. And the Supreme Court has said that the right to counsel is a critical part of ensuring justice for all. What that means is that if you are charged with a crime and you are facing the possibility of a sentence if you are convicted, then you have the right to have the guiding hand of counsel by your side. The court recognize that our system of criminal justice is extraordinarily complicated and that it would not be fair for any individual to have to navigate that system on their own. And that if you cannot afford a lawyer, if you cannot afford to hire private counsel, then the government has got to provide you one in those circumstances.
And the landmark case that gave birth to this right to counsel, right, because this doesn't go back all the way to the signing of the Constitution, was a case called Gideon versus Wainwright. And what did that case, what was that about?
That's right. The case of Gideon versus Wainwright is really the case that is most frequently cited for this right to counsel. The fact of the matter is that the court established this right over a series of cases. In Gideon, the individual was charged with a felony, and the court said in that circumstance that Mr. Gideon was, who had to mount his own defense, and he was convicted. He asked for a lawyer. He wasn't given one. And the court, the highest court of the land, said he should have had an attorney to represent him. And in that case where he was charged with a felony being a sort of more serious offense. But every Supreme Court case subsequently that has looked at this issue has expanded the right when, in fact, someone is charged with a crime and is facing a loss of liberty. So it extends to misdemeanor cases, it extends to juvenile cases, it extends to certain cases on appeal and in other situations. The bottom line is you should not be facing the powerful resources of the government without having the guiding hand of counsel at your side if you are going to be facing a loss of liberty, possibly locked up if you're convicted.
So this right to counsel, which, you know, we often hear, you know, if people watch Law and Order or other kinds of shows, right, they hear those, that kind of, you know, read me my rights, right? You hear the list of rights, and one of them is, if you can't afford a lawyer, one will be appointed for you. But what does this really mean in terms of public defender offices? How do they operate? How are they funded? How is the right to counsel actually implemented and enforced?
Well, the fact of the matter is that even though it's been more than 50 years since the Supreme Court case in Gideon versus Wainwright, there are people who are convicted in our courts who end up with convictions all across the country every day, who plead guilty in many instances, even when they're not guilty, who never actually talk to a lawyer. And in far too many cases, for individuals who do get assigned a counsel who can't afford counsel otherwise, far too often they end up with an attorney who doesn't really have the time or the resources or the training to adequately represent them. So the system, and in fact, when we talk about a system, that's sort of misleading because there is no single system of public defense in this country. It's really a lot of different systems across the country that operate very differently, but with some important things in common. And unfortunately, what is far too often the case is that they operate in a system where they do not have adequate resources to provide the type of representation that you would want if your mother or your brother or your sister or your child was charged with a criminal offense and locked up and facing the possibility of being locked up.
So you mentioned that people it can, despite having this constitutional right to counsel, can end up being charged with crimes but still not even end up having the opportunity to talk to a lawyer. How can that be?
Well, that happens in a lot of different ways, but one common way is this. You get arrested for an offense, you are put in jail, and you sit there for days or weeks, and unfortunately, sometimes I'm afraid to say for months, and then you get your day in court. And the judge may say to you, you're entitled to a lawyer, but we don't know when we can get you one. Or you could plead guilty now and go home today. Faced with that choice, many people are going to plead guilty whether or not they are guilty to get home to their loved ones, to their jobs, to their homes. And unfortunately, what often happens is as people sit in jail, they lose those opportunities. They lose their job, and that can have an incredible effect, as you can imagine, on then their housing, their livelihood, their ability to take care of their families or their children and themselves.
So a piece of this, as you describe it, sounds like it also has to do with poverty, right? It isn't just about underfunding of public defender offices, but also there's a system that exists wherein if you can't post bail, right, as you were describing, and someone's sitting in jail for days or weeks or even months pending trial because they can't post that $500 or whatever it is in bail, that those people then can end up disproportionately pleading guilty even to things that they didn't do.
Absolutely is very much about poverty. I mean, the bottom line is that in America, the quality of justice you receive should not depend on the amount of money you have. And unfortunately, that is far too frequently the case. So indeed, there has been study after study that has demonstrated the important role that counsel plays if they are assigned pre-trial in preventing unnecessary incarceration. And that translates into costs that you can quantify. So, for example, you know, jail costs. In fact, one of the most recent studies, one done in Baltimore, was one that showed that if counsel was available at the initial appearance, individuals are 2.5 times more likely to be able to go home, not to be detained. And so that has a direct impact, of course, on jail costs. And it has costs that are harder to quantify. How do you quantify the fact that the individual is able to keep their job, is able to keep their home, is able to be reunited with their family? And in addition, research study after study has shown that in an individual who's incarcerated, is that pretrial will have an impact on a negative impact on every stage of the case going forward. More likely to be convicted, more likely to be sentenced to imprisonment if you are convicted. And what it comes down to, obviously, if you can go out and afford counsel and have counsel right from the beginning, then you are much less likely, under the research and under the data, to remain incarcerated and to have those impacts.
Something that often gets called cumulative disadvantage, if I'm remembering that research literature correctly, right? So if you are someone who is incarcerated, you were saying, but I just want to reiterate this because I think it bears repeating, if you end up incarcerated pre-trial, you are more than twice as likely to be convicted and to end up actually serving a sentence than if you had not been incarcerated before trial.
Absolutely. It has negative consequences for your case, for the individual, for families, communities, and society at large. And one of those impacts is that it is critical for individuals to feel that our criminal justice system is fair, to have faith in the integrity of our justice system. And the American public understands that counsel is critical to the fairness of our courts and our criminal justice system. Indeed, in a recent study done by the National Center for State Courts just a few years ago, people were asked, what are good uses of taxpayer money for the courts to, you know, for the courts, to give the courts guidance in terms of their expenditures. And the number three answer was more public defenders, more public defense.
So getting back to once counsel is involved, right? So we've been talking a little bit about circumstances where a person cannot ever end up actually getting to see a lawyer before they plead guilty. But let's say we're in a situation where the person does get to meet with their public defender, and they are going to get to speak with that person. The underfunding of public defense can also make it incredibly hard for public defenders to keep up with their crushing caseloads, right? If I'm getting these numbers correctly, the American Bar Association says that the average caseload for a criminal defense lawyer should be at most 150 cases per year, which actually is a really large number, even that, right? But instead, in reality, because there aren't enough public defenders, as you were describing, these defenders can end up having 300 or more cases per year, twice what the ABA says would be appropriate. What kinds of consequences does that have for the quality of the defense that they can provide?
Yeah. In having crushing caseloads really comes down to this, and which is a public defender with crushing caseloads is not going to be able to provide each individual who is charged with a crime the type of meaningful representation that they deserve. At the end of the day, anybody who is entitled to the right to counsel should be confident that they are going to have a lawyer who is properly trained, who has the ability to communicate with them and not just see or talk to them for the first time, the moments before their trial, that they will have adequate access to an investigator to investigate the case, and if necessary, to expert witnesses. And the bottom line of those numbers, and indeed some of the numbers that you've cited, we have seen far greater numbers or higher numbers than that even. What it comes down to is that every individual who is entitled to have meaningful access and is entitled to the right to counsel does not get the type of representation that he or she deserves before being convicted of a crime.
So does this set up a system of basically structural malpractice for low-income people in terms of the kind of counsel that they're able to get?
At the end of the day, at every single person charged with a crime has the right to expect that their lawyer will provide competent counsel. And there are many ways to make sure that happens. One, of course, is making sure that there's adequate funding, and that is critically essential, and adequate funding, adequate resources. On the other hand, there's another way to deal with too many cases, and that is that you can either add more lawyers or you can have fewer cases coming into the system. And one of the things we need to do in this country is to take a look at all of the laws on the books to really look and see in what instances the criminal justice system is dealing with cases and issues that are best handled elsewhere. I mean, in too many instances, we have individuals who are in the system because they are individuals with a mental health issue that really should be addressed by another system, or because they are homeless, that too needs to be addressed elsewhere. And that, not only would that be better for the individuals who come into the system, for public defense lawyers across the country, but for our system and our country as a whole.
So it sounds like you're arguing that not only do we need criminal justice reform in order for there to be the hope and the chance of an adequate public defense system, but we also need public defenders to be able to do their jobs so that we can have meaningful criminal justice reform.
Yes, absolutely. Those issues are inextricably intertwined, the issue of criminal justice reform and access to counsel, and not just access to public defense counsel, criminal defense counsel, we haven't talked about the fact that civil legal aid plays a critically important role here as well. And while there is no federal constitutional right to civil legal aid, the fact of the matter is that system, too, is grossly underfunded, and that if it were adequately funded, number one, we would be able to address many of the issues that bring people into the criminal justice system on the front end, like lack of employment or housing or improper denial of access to other arenas of opportunity like education on the front end, as well as dealing with some of the barriers that are set up for people that help that result in people failing to meaningfully or successfully integrate into their communities on the back end as a result of the fact that even though they have served their sentence, they are faced with barriers again to employment and to educational access because of their conviction. Again, civil legal aid on the back end can help with so many of those issues.
Which, as we heard earlier in this episode, can also have ripple effects for not just individuals with criminal records, but also for their children, their families, and their whole communities. Joanne Wallace is the president and CEO of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. You can find out more about what NLADA does at www.nlada.org. And we look forward to having you back on the program to talk more about civil legal aid and how we can expand access to that as well. Thank you so much, Joanne.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us on Thursdays at 4 p.m. East, 1 p.m. West on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also find us on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. East, 8 a.m. West on the Progressive Voices Network using the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And don't forget to leave us a rating. Feel free to pitch us on Twitter via the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org.
See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clocks by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford 'cause my block ain't safe.